Now, this subject that I've chosen here this morning, I think could be very helpful. I think it can take the mystery out of what it means to know God. Remember in John 17, Christ's prayer, his last night on earth, was that these he was praying for, that they might know you. And Paul in Philippians 3:10 had a great deal to say about this. And he said, I pressed toward the mark for the prize. And the prize was that he might know God. He wrote that letter to the people at Philippi. And the city of Philippi was a retirement community, particularly military retirement. It was also the Indianapolis 500 of chariot racing. So most of those people have probably been to a chariot race. So when he was describing his pressing on to know God, you can just see the chariot driver there in the chariot, leaning forward over the horses, putting his knee against the front of the cart, pushing. And he said, forgetting those things that are behind, I press toward the mark for the prize, for the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. So that shows a little bit about his desire to seek to know God. So if I accomplish my objective here this morning, why, we're going to take the mystery out of what it means to know God. I have to be cautioned occasionally to turn my hearing aids down because my voice is comes through real good. And the conference last week, I didn't turn them down. I thought I was talking real loud and the people in back couldn't hear me there. So that happens occasionally, and may with you if you wear them, but you carry on a great conversation with yourself sometimes. Now, in the Bible, before it talks about what it is to that's the most important to God, the Scripture talks about what is not. So there's some verses from the Amplified Translation of the Jeremiah, verses 9:23 and 24. I didn't write it down, did I? Now, I like the way it starts out with this kind of authority. Thus says the Lord. So we don't need any greater authority or credibility than that, do we, for the truth to follow? Let not the wise and skillful person boast in his wisdom and skill. Let not the mighty and powerful person glory in his and boast in his strength and power. And let not the person who is rich glory and boast in his earthly riches. But on the positive side, but let him who glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me. And the Amplified says, personally and practically, for in these things I delight, says the Lord. So he said, it's not knowledge, it's not riches, it's not power. But if we want to delight the heart of God, we brag about that we understand and know him personally and practically. Now I want to mention, first of all, that there's a difference between knowing about a person and knowing a person. Is there not? But most of the books you read on knowing God are all about knowing about God and not about knowing God, ones I've read anyway. We were living in Washington, D.C. A few years ago when President Reagan was the president, and I had the opportunity to have a weekly Bible study and prayer with one of his top aides. So we went to the White House for an hour a week, and I met a lot of the people in there. We ate at the White House dining room, but I never saw Ronald Reagan any time I was in there. I never spoke to him. I sat in the audience where he spoke, but I don't know him. I know a great deal about him, but I don't know him. So there's a difference. We'll talk about the more as we go along. Now the next question is, who knows you better than any other human being, any other person? Now, who do you think knows you better than anybody else? Yes, I was in a meeting once, and I asked this question, and there's a lady sitting here, with her mother on one side and her husband on the other. And so I asked her which knew her the best. And she was a little bit shaky on it. So I said, how long have you been married? She said, 15 years. And I said, well, then it's a tie. Because it takes your spouse about 15 years to get to know you as well as your parents know you. Now, why is that? How well we know another person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. I've got about 14 of these, but that's important. And that's the one I want you to remember and take away. How well we know another person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Now suppose that I want to go back in years a little bit when you were a college student. Suppose I would take a 300-question questionnaire to the home of your parents and ask 300 questions, particularly from your mother, about you and how you would react in certain situations. Do you know that she could get every one of them correct? Why? Because she shared that experience with you, and she knew how you would react. So the way we get to know another person is through shared experiences. Now, some of you that are from Alabama, did you all know each other before you came? Did you come on a bus or fly out? How did you come? Well, if you sit to the next person all day, you probably got to know that person better than you did somebody else that you didn't sit next to. Or if you're rooming with somebody that you haven't previously known, you'll get to know them quite a bit. So I think this statement holds. I think it's important. How well we know another person is relative to the number and depths of shared experiences. Now, almost the same thing here, but this one says, how well we know God is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Is that right? Now, with this definition, is it possible that somebody who's been a Christian 10 years might know God better than somebody who's been a Christian 50 years? Did that happen? And probably does happen occasionally, doesn't it? Because how well we know another person, how well we know God, is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Now, what does it mean to share experiences with God? I think we ought to think about that for a little bit. Well, probably we had some minor experiences with God before we became Christians. But one day, we shared our sinful life and past with Him. And He shared the forgiveness of sins and everlasting life to us. Well, we remember that pretty well, don't we? That the shared experience of salvation. And then there was that first answer to prayer. You remember about that? You shared a request with Him, and He came through with the answer. So we shared lots of experiences in prayer. And then it's happened to all of us that God just divinely intervened to protect us in a bad situation. And we remember that. And in our health, we've had His touch, haven't we? He shared in our life. And then you remember the time that He asked you to do something. And you were very reluctant. Kind of a tough assignment. But you did it. And then your heart overflowed with the joy of obedience. So these are the kind of experiences we're talking about. What does it mean to share experiences with God? Where that there's an interchange, and we give him something, he gives us something. Now, how well we know a person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. However, most people that I know are not doing what it says in Jeremiah 9:23 and 24, boast about knowing me. Most people I know whose lives are not dedicated to Christ want knowledge, which results in riches, which results in power. Isn't that the sequence? Well, Jeremiah, quoting what God said, he said, now, this isn't it. That's not what's important. It's not knowledge. It's not riches. It's not power. It is knowing me. The a person from whom the Navigators bought Glen Eyrie was one of the 50 richest men in America, an oil man from Texas. And there's a piece of property out along the front here that the city wanted for a city park. So they would call him, they'd write him letters. He would ignore them totally. You see, you go from riches to power. That's the real reason you want knowledge and riches, is so you can exercise power over people. So he could ignore the mayor and the city council. You know, he had the money. Just leave me alone. I don't even have to speak to you. But most people that I know, as I say, that's the route they're going. I want to get all the education I can get so I can make money. And once I've got money, then I can control my time and the time of other people. I've got power over those things. Now, it's wonderful that the Bible, I see I got a misspelled word. I did these between 2:30 and 4 o'clock this morning, and I see I misspelled a word. I just see one in there yet. I don't know how to turn it on or not. But in the, well, that should be knowing God. Delights him more than having knowledge. If I said that, I would not have credibility because I don't have a lot of knowledge. But Moses said that in Exodus 33:13. He told God, he said, now, if I found favor with you, I really want to know you. And his prayer was answered. Deuteronomy 34:10 tells us that there was never a person that knew God face to face like Moses. Now I want to tell you a little about Moses that you may or not have heard. Josephus is a Jewish historian. Some of you are familiar with his writings. He lived at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. He said there is no single volume that contains the entire history of the Jews from their beginning up to now. So he wrote what is called the Antiquities of the Jews. And he uses the Bible as a resource, but he did a lot of other research. And his research on Moses is fascinating. He says that the princess who pulled Moses out of the water, her name was Thermuthis, and she was the only member of the family that could produce an heir to the throne, and she had no son. And so she was worried about it. King and queen were worried about it. Here we have no successor. So when she pulled Moses out, she took him to the king, according to Josephus, and said, here's your heir. This will be your heir. Well, the king responded, according to Josephus, by said, well, see that he's educated with the greatest of care. Now, in those days, there was an expression, to be educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. It meant somebody, by the way, we think that Moses went to college at the College of On, located in Heliopolis, 6 miles from Cairo, and to graduate, you had to take all the courses offered by the college and get the equivalent of a PhD in every one of them. It took about 20 years to get through. So Moses had advanced degrees in medicine, in sanitation, in surveying, in military science, and poetry, language, you name it. Well, when Stephen was giving his speech before the Sanhedrin, he just made this remark. Moses was educated in all the knowledge of the Egyptians. He was very likely the most highly educated man of his day. But he said that wasn't important to him. What he wanted to do was to get to know God. Now, Daniel establishes another part of the credibility of this. Knowing God delights him more than having power. It appears that, according to some historians, after Cyrus sent his general, Gobryas, to conquer the Babylonian Empire, that he set up a combination of military and civilian government in the Babylonian Empire. And you remember, he put three people in charge. Well, I guess he didn't trust the locals, so he brought old Daniel out of mothballs, who was over 90 years old, and put him in charge of the three. And he was doing such a good job that Cyrus, according to the Bible, was about to give him that same job over the entire Medo-Persian Empire, make him the second most powerful person in the world. According to some historians, Daniel kept the cabinet posts where there was the most opportunity for graft to keep the other people honest. So he was the equivalent of the Secretary of State and the Treasurer and the Interior, and I don't know what other the cabinet positions he held, but was probably, next to the king, the most politically powerful person in his day. But in Daniel 11:32, he said, "It's they who know God that do great exploits." And you remember when he chose between doing what God wanted and being spared thrown in the line of dens. He proved that knowing God is more important than power. As we think about Abraham, a man of faith, but he also was probably the richest man of his generation. Genesis 13:2 said, "Now Abram was very rich in gold, silver, and livestock." He had a well-balanced portfolio. Very likely the richest man of his day. But when he had an opportunity to get to know God better through an experience of offering his own son, he chose that experience with God that he might get to know him better. Now, David was also in this same fraternity, and he showed us that knowing God is progressive. So let's just think for a minute about his encounter with Goliath. And, this teenager went down to the front to take some food to his brothers. Military food. I spent 24 years in the military. It doesn't have the greatest reputation, either for taste or quantity. So no wonder his parents set down a little special food for his brothers in the army. And remember when David arrived, he saw this giant challenging the whole army. And he told his brothers, "Hey, it's God he's challenging, not the army." And they explained to him what the situation was, that it was between the giant and an Israelite. He said, "Fight it out. Whoever won, the other army would surrender." So David said, "I'll do it." And they took him to Saul. Saul was really in need of a hero at that point, was he not? And, he almost did it. But even old hard-hearted Saul, he said, "I can't send this teenager out there to get slaughtered by the giant." So he told David, "Much as I need a hero and the like, I can't let you do it." And David said, Well, your servant used to take care of the sheep. That's my job. And he said, a bear came, and I grabbed him and killed him. And a lion came, and I grabbed him and killed him. And then he told Saul, he said, the Lord who delivered me out of the paw of the bear and the mouth of the lion will deliver me from this giant. And Saul caught on. And he said, oh, I understand. And then he said, go, and the Lord go with you. Oh, I see. The Lord is going to undertake. Okay, I get the point. Now, I think that David, I don't know what the first thing was that attacked his sheep, but maybe it was a coyote. Maybe it was a wild dog. But he learned what God does with a coyote. He saw how God handles a wild dog. He saw how God handles a bear. He saw God handles a lion. And he knew that God would handle a giant in the same way. And then after the giant, David went on to oppose all of Saul's army. And then eventually he opposed a League of Nations and conquered all of them here. So knowing God is progressive. And you know, if we're going to keep growing, we're always going to be presented with a little greater challenge to trust and obey God. He will not let us be content. So David belonged to a fraternity, and he spoke about it in Psalm 36:10. And he said, that's the fraternity of those that know God. So he had all these things, wisdom, riches, power, but he said, knowing God, that's the big deal. Now, I'll tell you a story here. I speak to young people quite a bit. None of them ever heard of Damon Runyon. But I expect most of you have heard of Damon Runyon, the sports writer. Well, he died with cancer, you remember. And some of his friends got together and put together what they thought were his best writings. And they called this book The Best of Damon Runyon. And Damon Runyon wrote never in first person. It was always his father that had these experiences. I don't know why he did that, whether it protected him or not. But he told about the time that an interviewer came with a questionnaire up to his father's door. And he said, your name's been given as a reference for this person. Could you give me some information? So he gave him his name, and he says, you do know him, don't you? And Damon Runyon's father said, no, I can't say that I do. And he said, well, they gave me your name. There must be some reason that they know they gave me your name. Have you ever heard of him? Oh, yes, I've heard of him. Well, how'd you hear about him? No, what's the connection? So Damon Runyon's father said, well, I owned a hardware store. And he said, I took him in as a partner. And he said, we worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 4 years. And he said, by the way, we were very compatible socially. And we always spent our Sundays together and our vacations together. And the interviewer said, and you say that you don't know him? And Damon Runyon's father said, no, I can't say that I do. Well, you can imagine the frustration of the interviewer. He said, why would you say that? 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, all day Sunday, all your vacations. He said, well, before I had him as a partner, I had another person. And he said it was the identical situation. He said, one winter, we were on a hunting trip. And a blizzard came up. And we found refuge in an old cabin, but there wasn't any heat in it. And we had one blanket between us. And he said, so we got it close together, put the blankets over it. He said, every little bit, I'd wake up cold. And I'd look, and he had pulled that blanket off of me and wrapped up in it. He said, now, I never thought he'd do a thing like that. So he said, I'll never say that I know a person until we've been caught in a blizzard with one blanket. Well, I'm sure we see the application that as long as there's just one unshared experience, we don't really know the other person. How well we know a person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Now, I want to ask you a question here. You have a close friend, and the friend moves out of town. And you keep in touch by phone and correspondence for a little while, and then pretty soon you just lose touch. What happens to the relationship? Well, it just sort of fades. That's what happens when you don't continue to share experiences. How about with God? What happens when we stop sharing experiences with God? What happens to the relationship? Well, just may fade and be a thing of the past unless we are sharing experience continuous. Now I've got another question right down here. Why do we stop sharing experiences with another person? I'm talking about somebody that's real close now. Well, I can tell you my experience. If I'm afraid they won't approve of what I'm about to do, I don't tell them about it. All right? Yeah, I don't want to take them into my confidence on this because they might have a different idea. Why do we stop? Because they might not approve. Why do we stop sharing experience with God? He might have a different idea. So we just leave him out of it and go our own way. And then the relationship further deteriorates. Well, some of us are getting along in years, and I think might have the idea that our ability to delight the heart of God diminishes with age. But that is not true. Since how well we know God is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences, we can delight Him more and more as we grow older. And, you know, that makes the transition into heaven a little less abrupt, isn't it? Because in our older years, we're getting to know Him better and better, and then it's just a simple transition as we continue after that. Well, you're going to discuss these things a little later. I think everything's ahead of time. I wasn't figuring on taking more than a half hour with you. That I know what happens to my attention span at my age. And, I'm sure that we all hear the same stories about you know, when you get a little bit older. That I think there's a poem written about this. I don't know all of it, about a senior citizen that was telling about his situation. He said, well, the first thing that happened was that my eyes began to get weak. And he said, I got these glasses, and they do a pretty good job. And he said, after that, it was my hearing. And he said, I got these buzz a little bit, but he said, you know, I get along all right on it. And he said, my back began to go. But he said, with the help of this cane, I was able to get along all right. He said, it's my mind that I miss. So our attention span does diminish a little bit as we go on. Now, you're going to discuss these things, but I just kind of like to review and wrap it up. That's one of the questions I submitted for you to discuss. Is there a difference between knowing about a person and knowing a person? Now, that's one of the discussion questions. And the other question is, one of the others is, do you agree with this statement I made, that I've got it on the other slide, but it was on this one. How well we know God is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Is that right? Well, let's say those two things together. The first one will be, how well we know another person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Let's say that together. How well we know another person is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Now, how well we know God is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Say that together. How well we know God is relative to the number and depth of shared experiences. Okay, I'm finished, unless there's some comment or question. Yes. Okay. Did you hear the question?
Well, I don't know what to say. Oh, they didn't. Oh, the question. All right, we'd like to hear your shared experience since you've been a navigator so long of the things that you've learned and how it all came about, because we appreciate the foresight that they had for us to be able to share.
Yes, I first met Dawson Trotman when I was 19 and he was 27. That was 1933. And I had a naval career. I spent 24 years in the Navy. And the main reason I was in the service was to further the ministry of the navigators. Now, that's what I gave my life to. That's where he called me. So I was still on active duty in the Navy when Glen Eyrie was purchased, but I was in close touch. Young Life Campaign. You're familiar with Young Life Campaign? Jim Rayburn was the founder of it. Their headquarters here in Colorado Springs. And he knew that Dawson Trotman was looking for a piece of property that could serve as a place for an office and training of young people, and a conference center. The office in Los Angeles couldn't do that. Well, about that time, Billy Graham was looking for a conference center for Up and Outers. And this property came on the market. Well, a local realtor was working with both Billy Graham and with the navigators. So they located 20 acres out by the Air Force Academy that looked like that would be suitable for the navigators. So the navigators were negotiating for that 20 acres. And Billy Graham was negotiating for this property. Well, about after the negotiations got serious, Billy Graham's advisors told him it would be wrong to take money that he raised for ministry and put it into real estate. So he decided, you know, that's the way to go. Well, the agreement that had been drawn up with the owner of this property, a man named George Strake, was that the option was for Billy Graham and or associates. Well, Dawson Trotman, being in charge of the follow-up ministry of the Billy Graham Association, qualified as an associate. So Billy Graham said, we'll turn the option over to you if you can raise the money. Now, by the way, the 20 acres that the navigators were negotiating for is now the home of the Air Force Academy. And the main building that would have been taken over by the navigators is now the superintendent's residence. So if the navigators had taken the property out of the Air Force Academy, why, it would no longer be available. Well, the navigators put together a fundraising campaign. The down payment was $340,000 on the property, fully furnished. So they had to come up with a down payment in a month, which they did. The local banks financed the rest over 10 years. By the way, Colorado in November is going to vote on whether or not to put nonprofit organizations on the tax rolls. So they value this property at $4.5 million. And if we go on the tax rolls, our real estate tax will be $92,000 a year. Now, I don't think the voters are going to pass it, but this is the first state in the union that has put that on a ballot. And that means churches, nonprofit, everything, be placed on the tax rolls. Well, then in 1953, the money was raised, the down payment was made. They sent a crew here to get it ready to occupy. 1954, moved the office from Los Angeles here. Now, I should say that the arrangement that Billy Graham kept in touch with Dawson Trotman, and he wanted the Navigators, instead of getting the property out, the Air Force Academy, to live here. And they would maintain the place, and he would give them office space. But Billy Graham would keep the castle, the pink house, and the main parts for his ministry. So the Navigators would be caretakers. But there's a film available on this, a 22-minute film at the Visitor Center, that they have a copy of the conference office. I think that might be a good thing for you to see during your free time. Also, in the bookstore, there's a story called The Glenary Story that's got other details on this. So I think if you're interested in more details, this, all the specifics are in the film and in the book. Okay, is there any other question or comment anybody has? Yes. I didn't hear the first part.
Over by Cedar Ridge, there's a sign that says you go up this trail and you come to his gravesite.
Yes. Dawson Trotman, Time magazine had a good write-up the month after he was drowned. But he was in a speedboat with Jack Wirtson, who's the director of the Word of Life Hour up in Upper New York. And he was sitting between two girls that couldn't swim. That's the reason he was sitting there, because he knew they couldn't swim. And so they had their arms locked together. The lake was kind of rough. So Jack Wirtson made a quick turn, and the girl on one side fell over and pulled him over. And the other broke her arm. So he helped her up until she could be rescued. But the minute they pulled her out of his arms, they saw his arms just fade apart, and he died with that last effort. Well, the memorial service was held here at Glen Eyrie. He had only been here less than 3 years, and Billy Graham conducted the service. And it was at that time there are now regulations against burial on private property, but there was not at that time. So his favorite spot on Glen Eyrie was picked out up on the ridge, where he used to go and pray and scratch verses in the rocks. And so we dug out a grave, and he's buried up there. And you can hike up to that grave. It's not too steep a hike. You just have a little time. There's a big slab there with all the information on it. Okay, is there any other comment or any other question? His wife, Lila, lives in the city here. She's the same age as I am. Her birthday is December. Mine's in August. She's had a hip replacement recently and is in a wheelchair. But she's very much alive, and three of her four children live in Colorado Springs also.